rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Jeffrey Feldman's going to be here later on in the program with the latest Frame Shop is Open frame. He suggests Democrats should unroll the security plan, and now they must become the party to ask the questions. Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org will tell us why the Army banned the use of privately bought armor. But our question for this hour, are our trade policies destroying America? And we're going to be digging into that in some depth. First, though, I just yesterday, we've had several people have called this program over the last couple of days and said, you've got to go out and see the movie V for Vendetta. And or just V, I guess, is enough. And so yesterday afternoon, Louise and I had to do a local fundraising gig for the schools here in Portland. And afterwards, we had lunch and went to the movie and the afternoon matinee. And it was amazing. And so I had to come back and read all about the history of Guy Fawkes and the Gunpowder Rebellion in 1605 against King James the First, or the attempt to blow up the Parliament Building in 1605. But I've got to say, this is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant movie. It is a brilliant movie in the context of as movies are made. You know, just the whole idea of characters who are driven, who change through the course of the movie, there's a love story embedded in the thing. That just all of the stuff that makes a good movie, it's all there. And the political message of this movie is mind-boggling. And it takes place in 20 years in the future, more or less, in the United Kingdom. And I would say that this movie is this generation's version of what, for my generation, was George Orwell's book 1984. Because, you know, back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, everybody had to read 1984 in high school, and everybody got it that this was the dystopian view. This was the anti-utopia. This was the world that none of us wanted. And that all of us knew that if evil people took over government and government had too much power, this is what it would end up like. And nowadays, you know, kids graduate from high school and they have no idea what that book, 1984, by George Orwell, was, what it said. I mean, you know, maybe they've heard about it, but it's not required reading anymore. And so it's like there's this, I'd say, you know, probably anybody born in the last 30 years, maybe. Perhaps somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of, you know, gee, I studied this in school thus and so. But, I mean, you know, back in the 60s when I was in high school, we had to read it. And I think it's probably been since the 70s, since anybody's had to read 1984. So we've got a generation of people who don't have an anthem. They don't have a story. They don't have this is what it could be like. This is how horrible it could be. And this is how we should respond to it. And this movie, V for Vendetta, I would say, made by I believe it's the Wachowski brothers. Is that how it's pronounced? And I'm not sure. But the same guys who did Matrix. And just a brilliant movie. So my movie review of the day, and also political commentary. Our quote for the day, by the way, from Albert Einstein, never do anything against conscience, even if the state demands it. Even if the state demands it. And by the way, George W. Bush, there's a juxtaposition here that I think is so important. To just, you know, get this juxtaposition. George W. Bush speaking about the insurgency in Iraq yesterday.
That are trying to create enough chaos so that America loses nerve. And I'm not going to lose my nerve as the president.
I'm not going to lose my nerve. Now, he's not, as far as I know, he's not the guy that's being shot at. He's not the guy that has the bullets flying around him. He's not the guy who's being dragged out of a burning helicopter on videotape today. He's not the guy who is having to drive around Iraq in unarmored Humvees. He's not the guy who has just been told by the Defense Department that he can't wear body armor that his parents sent to him because it's not government issued. But by the way, we don't have enough government issued body armor. He's not the guy. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody in the Bush family is. There are some 20 plus members of the Bush family. I mean, direct, you know, brothers, sisters, nephews, cousins, children, grandchildren of the Bush family, of George and Barbara Bush, who are of an age where they are eligible for military service. None are serving. None in the Cheney family serving. And, you know, just go right on through the list of neocons. You know, is anybody from Paul Wolfowitz's family serving? No. Doug Feith? No. Richard Pearl? No. And on the list goes. In fact, you can go through the list of the Republican elite. And in virtually every single case, the answer will be no. So I think it's, you know, it's, this is more of that bantam rooster. Jack Cafferty yesterday talking about Tom DeLay. This is how on CNN. This is how he described Tom DeLay.
A big, tough-talking, strong-arm artist who could deliver votes to the Bush White House. He would strut around on Capitol Hill like a cocky little bandy rooster, but today he slithered away from Congress to await his fate at the hands of the criminal justice system. Good riddance.
Yeah, and I would say this, and not by way of saying, oh, gee, I'm complaining about George W. Bush. But the point is that for Bush to try to spin this as it's about his nerve, when our young men and women are over in Iraq, inadequately armored, still to this day in many cases, fighting a war for which the rationale was purely political. I spoke this morning with Joe Wilson, and he referenced Mickey Herskowitz's comments about George W. Bush's suggestion to him back before he was, before he even was running for president, when Mickey Herskowitz was writing Bush's autobiography, A Charge to Keep, as being the most craven of all reasons, the most craven possible reason to go to enter a war is for politics. As Cindy Sheehan pointed out before John Conyers' commission.
Roosevelt is dead.
Excuse me, that's not Cindy Sheehan. That's
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. And now George W. Bush saying he's not going to lose his nerve. Well, I would say the American people are saying, you got a lot of nerve to say that. Not unlike the last third George to rule a major world power. On August 23rd, 1775, King George III, in response to the hostility in the American communities, produced a proclamation of rebellion. "Whereas many of our subjects in diverse parts of our colonies and plantations in North America, misled by dangerous and ill-designing men, and forgetting the allegiance which they owe to the power that has protected and supported them." Now, can't you just imagine George W. Bush saying this to the people of Iraq? You know, "You're forgetting that we're here to protect you. After various disorderly acts committed in disturbance of the public peace, to the obstruction of lawful commerce, and to the oppression of our loyal subjects carrying on the same, have at length proceeded to open an avowed rebellion by arraying themselves in a hostile manner to withstand the execution of the law and traitorously preparing, ordering, and levying war against us. And whereas there is reason to apprehend that such rebellion hath been much promoted and encouraged by the traitorous correspondence, counsels, and comfort of diverse wicked and desperate persons within this realm. To the end, therefore, that none of our subjects may neglect or violate their duty through ignorance thereof, or through any doubt of the protection which the law will afford to their loyalty and zeal, they have thought fit by and with the advice of our Privy Council to issue our royal proclamation, hereby declaring that not only all our officers, civil and military, are obligated to exert their utmost endeavors to suppress such rebellion and to bring the traitors to justice, but that all our subject to this realm and the dominions thereto belonging are bound by law to be aiding and assisting in the suppression of such rebellion, and to disclose and make known all traitorous conspiracies and attempts against our crown and dignity. Yes. King George III, April 23rd, 1775. Eerily familiar. 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
One day you get what you want, but it's not what you think. Then you get what you need. Well, oh, that's the way it is. You gotta roll with the punches.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Are our trade policies destroying America? I know I got started here on this the comparison between George III of England and the third George to be president of the United States, George W. Bush, because I just, you know, this comment that he made in the press yesterday was just so over the top. I just, you know, couldn't let the thing slide by. But, well, in fact, we'll get back to our trade policies in just a second. But Luke in Grand Rapids wants to weigh in on the issue and apparently disagrees with me, so he goes to the front of the line. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I haven't been catching much of the show, so sorry if I'm out of a lot of context, but I was hearing how King George of England was portrayed to be quite similar to W. And I just can't imagine you'd actually do that. I mean, it's kind of like the teacher in Colorado saying that W has eerie similarities to Hitler.
You didn't hear the whole thing.
I did. Please provide context. So.
Yeah, sure. My point was that George W. Bush gave this comment yesterday. Hang on just a second here. Here we go.
That are trying to create enough chaos so that America loses nerve, and I'm not going to lose my nerve as the president.
And my point was, it's not his nerve that we have to worry about. It's the nerve of our soldiers, and they are out there. They're ill-equipped, they're ill-served, and they are facing an insurgency that is the Iraqi people. We are fighting against the Iraqi people. All the time we're claiming that we're protecting the American people, the Iraqi people. We're fighting against the Iraqi people. The vast majority, 87% of the Iraqi people, want us out now. The majority of our own soldiers want us out now. We are now in an occupation position. Yes, we had a war. Yes, we won the war. And yes, in the first month or so, we could have actually done something successful in Iraq. We didn't. We blew it. George W. Bush now is 3 years into an occupation where the Iraqi people have become the enemies of our own soldiers. And that's a situation, that's the same situation that King George III found himself in with regard to the United States. That was my point. And that's why I was quoting King George III.
Yeah, I just don't agree because, I mean, 80% that you're saying that the Iraqis want the American troops out. I mean, who are you quoting? Are you quoting Al Jazeera? Because I know where they quote.
I'm quoting a Zoghbi poll that was done.
Oh, okay. Because I think when the president actually says that he doesn't lose his nerve, I think it's quite appropriate because he represents the troops and the troops look to him. And I think it's quite a he's personifying the troops and trying to be the leader that he needs to be. I don't think we should take him so literally as if he's trying to protect his presidency.
I don't think for a minute, Luke, that I don't even for a minute think that George W. Bush gives a damn about our troops. If he did, he wouldn't be suggesting $6 billion less for the Veterans Administration this year than the Veterans Administration itself says it needs. If he cared about the troops, he wouldn't have sent them into harm's way with unarmored Humvees. He would have made some plans for after the occupation. He wouldn't have dissed General Zinni and Shinseki as he did. He wouldn't have lied us into a war in the first place.
How did he lie us into a war, Tom? We're going around this whole argument again. If he lied us into the war, then everyone else was lying too.
No, everyone else was not lying. The vast majority of the world was saying, let's enforce 1440. 1440, the United Nations Resolution 1440, said that the United Nations would not authorize the use of force in Iraq until one of two conditions was met. Either Hans Blix came forward and said, we find evidence of... Either Hans Blix or Mohammed El-Baradei came forward and said, we find evidence of weapons of mass destruction, or we find evidence that they are concealing weapons of mass destruction. And they never did that. They never said that. We had to go back to the UN after the war to get a retroactive approval because we were in violation of international law when we started bombing Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the world did not think that there were weapons of mass destruction there. The rest of the world thought that there in all probability there weren't. Hans Blix was out there saying
Iraq sits on top.
We got the wrong buttons here today. This is Hans Blix.
You know, in the Middle Ages when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them. And this is a bit risky. I think we were more judicious in saying that we want to have real evidence, and I'm not going to cite what the intelligence agencies are saying unless I have the evidence for it. If I had that, well, then I would do it.
And now we know also that George W. Bush lied to us about not wanting to go to war. This was just published by the New York Times last week. When Bush was saying,
you say we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
And yet last week, the New York Times published a new memo out of London saying, during the private two-hour meeting in the Oval Office on January 31st, 2003, Bush made clear to Prime Minister Tony Blair of Britain that he was determined to invade Iraq without the second resolution from the United Nations. This was the one that I said 1441 requires. Or even if international arms inspectors fail to find unconventional weapons, said a confidential memo. The memo indicates the two leaders envisioned a quick victory and a transition to Iraqi government would be complicated but manageable. Mr. Bush predicated that it was unlikely, and it goes on. I mean, basically, he was, at the time that he was telling us he wasn't going to go to war, he was planning on going to war. And he was lying to us. He lied to you, Luke. He lied to me. He lied to our soldiers in the field. And increasingly, they know it. Well, I'm saying, whether you agree or not, I mean, this is the fact. Go back and read the Downing Street memo. Just Google Downing Street memo. It's very simple. You can read. This is the actual British intelligence service saying Bush is going to lie to us about the war. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It's all good. It's all right. But it's always a good day when you're glad to be alive. Everything I need ain't too hard to find. Why don't waste my time complaining? Cause I don't see how I could.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Time now for a Berlusconi alert. Yes, old Silvio, he's up to it again. Silvio Berlusconi, you'll recall the guy who bought a radio, the small-time crook in Italy, bought a radio and businessman, but all of his business associates now, or most of them, are in prison. He's managed to avoid it so far, in part because his own ruling party said that he can't be prosecuted while he's prime minister. Anyhow, he bought a radio station, then he bought a TV station, then he bought another radio station, then another TV station, then a newspaper, then another newspaper, then another TV, then a TV network, and then a radio network. And when he finally owned all the radio networks and all the TV networks and most of the major newspapers in Italy, then he ran for political office. Created a political party and ran for office, and guess what? He got elected, Silvio Berlusconi. Well, he's been in office now for 5 years, and the people are over it in Italy. He's trailing his opponent. And so here's the story from the Financial Times. Silvio Berlusconi, prime minister, caused an uproar in Italy's election campaign on Wednesday by threatening to appear in an unscheduled television interview that risked breaking national election laws. Mr. Berlusconi dropped his plans to appear on Canal 5, Channel 5, a channel owned by his own company, Mediaset TV Empire, after opposition politicians expressed outrage, and Italy's commercial TV regulator urged respect for the rules. Oh, it's all about Silvio. So, our Berlusconi alert for the day. Silvio, up to it again. No surprise there. No surprise there. Page 4 of Sunday's Washington Post. This William Rivers Pitt wrote this thing for Truth Out, and is very, very well said. This is page 4 of Sunday's Washington Post, carries a story titled, The President as Average Joe. And it's all about how George W. Bush is trying to reinvent himself as, you know, like just the average guy. Most of us, writes William Rivers Pitt, presumably don't know a single average Joe type who could pull off a trick like the one reported by the New York Times last week. Another memo out of Iraq, which I shared in part with you just a few minutes ago. The memo also shows that the president and the prime minister acknowledged that no unconventional weapons had been found inside Iraq. Now, this is before the invasion, Blair and Bush meeting, and the records of the meeting demonstrate that they both agreed that Saddam Hussein had no weapons. He presented no threat to the United States. The veracity, the accuracy, the reality of this memo has not been disputed, either by Bush or by Blair. Neither one of them are saying that this is not true. They agreed, according to this memo, according to the memos of this meeting, that Saddam Hussein represented no threat to anybody. Faced with the possibility of not finding any before the planned invasion, Mr. Bush talked about several ways to provoke a confrontation, including a proposal to paint a United States surveillance plane in the colors of the United Nations in the hopes of drawing fire or assassinating Mr. Hussein. Yeah, the average Joe can really do that. And then in the meantime, he comes back home and he says to us,
we must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001, America felt its vulnerability, even to threats that gather on the other side of the earth.
And right after mentioning 9/11, he continues,
first, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
And he wraps it up.
Facing clear evidence of peril, we cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
And yet at the same time, he's sitting here with Tony Blair saying, we know there's no reason for this war, but we're both going to get some serious political capital from it. And maybe some oil. Frank in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Frank, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Okay. Now, I'm the guy that's going to, from Dallas, going to talk about, oh, is this,
you're
am
on
I
air,
on?
Frank, you're on air.
Hey, listen, I've always wondered why or how the military plans to do bombing when we attack a country, that if we thought there were weapons of mass destruction, how do we avoid hitting them and blowing and killing everyone, you know, blowing it up?
Well, not just killing everyone there, but killing everyone downwind of there, which, you know, could even go as far as our ally Israel.
Yeah, but I mean, have you ever asked a military expert how they do the bombing? I mean, what do they know, you know, what targets do they hit and...
Well, I suspect, you know, in acknowledging the competence of our military, which is very competent, I suspect that they were probably not trying to hit any sites that they may have thought had weapons of mass destruction. Although at that point, it was fairly obvious to everybody there were no weapons of mass destruction. Everybody in the world was saying there are no weapons of mass destruction, except for Bush and Blair. I know to this day. There are Republican shills doing the talking head circuit and on TV shows saying, well, the French thought there were weapons of mass destruction. The Germans thought there were. Everybody thought there were. No, all of those, the Russians, you had Vladimir Putin saying, we don't think that there's any weapons of mass destruction. You had the Prime Minister of Germany, what's his name, saying, Kohl, saying there's no weapons of mass destruction. The only guy who was going along with it, frankly, was Silvio Berlusconi. And in fact, it turns out that the phony memo, that forged memo about the uranium in Niger, came out of the intelligence service of Italy. This was a favor that Berlusconi was trying to do to Bush, and it was, everybody figured out that the thing was a phony before Bush went ahead and used it, which is, you know, why Joe Wilson felt the need to out it. But in any case, I'd say no. Instead of bombing weapons of mass destruction sites, because there weren't any, they were bombing what they considered to be political targets, you know, office buildings, government office buildings and things like that. And let's not forget that according to the most conservative estimates, the actual body counts done in the hospitals, somewhere between 20 and 30,000 people died as a result of our bombing of Iraq. According to The Lancet, a study that was done based on, you know, projecting out deaths based on known deaths, around 100,000 people died. Most of those just, you know, the bodies never showed up at a hospital. And
so what you're really saying is that the military didn't really believe they were going to be blowing up any weapons of mass destruction.
No, I don't think the military believed that. I think that if they believed that, they would have had a different strategy for going into the country.
That's interesting.
You don't put your soldiers in the face of something like that. I mean, if we were invading Russia, the strategy would be completely different. No, yeah. I don't believe it for a minute. Tommy Franks, these guys are not dumb. They knew what was going on, and Bush certainly knew. Frank, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along.
Thanks, Tom. Bye.
Paul in Long Island. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, Tom, great job. Love the show.
Thank you.
I just want to say, I saw Bill O'Reilly when he was on Letterman, and Letterman essentially said, you know, like, Bush lied to us about the weapons of mass destruction. And O'Reilly said that, well, how come then that the English intelligence, the Russian intelligence, the, I don't know who else he mentioned, French intelligence, yeah, whatever, he said they all corroborated, you know, Bush's assessment that they had weapons of mass destruction. And it's like, where's he getting that from? I mean,
He pulled it out of his ear. I mean, these guys literally have made this up, and they have made this up, and they have repeated it so often that people in America actually think it's true.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know of nothing that was that has come to light that indicates that there's any truth to that.
There were no credible reports from the intelligence services of any nations, and, you know, the United Nations was saying, hey, give them to us if you've got us. If mm-hmm. you've got them. Hans Blix, please give them to us. Mohammed al-Baradei, tell me where to go. I mean, he said it to Don Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld said, we know where the weapons are. They're up there in the triangle, you know, just northwest of Baghdad. And Mohammed al-Baradei said, fine, give us a, you know, give me some coordinates and I'll take them out for you. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. So, no, none of the countries, to the best of my knowledge, none of the countries of the world, by the time the inspectors were done, thought that there were any weapons there of any
kind. That O'Reilly could come on national television and just fabricate that.
But it's not just O'Reilly. I mean, this is, you know, Scott McClellan has been saying this. George Bush has been saying this. Dick Cheney has been saying this is the Republican talking point. And the reality is that the rest of the world didn't think that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And that's why you had the largest demonstrations in the history of the world. People out in the streets saying,
well, you know what you're going to be hearing now is, because I was watching, there's a guy out who was a general for Saddam Hussein who I guess was in the head of his air force or something. And he's saying now that he wrote a book.
Yeah, I know. I saw him on The Daily Show.
Exactly. And this guy is saying, you know, blah, blah, that, yeah, the pilots saw it, and they flew to all the Syria. So that's going to be the next wave of propaganda.
Oh, sure, and it'll provide a nice excuse for us to have a nice little war over in Syria. But the fact of the matter is, when John Stewart asked him, did you ever actually see any of this stuff, his answer was no.
Yeah, and we all know that no general who worked for Saddam Hussein would ever lie or anything like that.
Or take a lot of money from conservative think tanks to write a book. No, mm-hmm. wouldn't happen, no.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. I got to move along. Dennis in Decatur, Illinois. Hey, Dennis.
You know, it is unbelievable to me the stupidity of our president.
I don't think he's a stupid man, Dennis. That's what concerns me.
Arrogant? Well, wait a minute.
I'll give you arrogance. I'm not going to give you stupidity.
Two things. The HSA thing is a big pile of whatever. I had an HSA last year. My company tried them last year. 80% of the people that had HSAs.
Dennis, I got to ask you what. The health savings accounts. Dennis, hold the line for just a second. We'll pick up this conversation on the other side of the break. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You could spread your wings and fly, and you could try to go so high in the sky that you never come down. You can follow every dream, but when it seems everything you believe never works out,
and welcome back.
Remember, I'm right here for you.
There you go. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, 50 minutes past. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466. George W. Bush.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons, and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
Now, technically, that was true when he said it, because his father had sold them that stuff and helped them produce it. But he also knew at that time that all of that stuff, even if Saddam still had it, was so out of date that it was useless. And he also knew that Scott Ritter and the UN weapons inspectors had destroyed 97% of everything that could be found, and that the current inspectors couldn't find anything. Dennis in Decatur. Hey, Dennis, let's finish up this conversation.
Finish up, and then I'll get, you know, this real quick. Sure. We have the HSA. You're right. It's a shell game.
The health savings account. Yeah.
Yeah, the health savings account. Because 80% of the people that had it had problems with it. I turned out to be one of the people to explain to them how to manage it properly. But even so, 80% of us, and I was one of those included, said, this is, does it nothing for us, and we went back to the old plan.
Yeah.
Even the
yeah.
company thought it was an idiot idea.
Yeah, yeah, we're hearing that from a lot of folks. But did you
want to... But now on this other thing.
On the war, yeah.
Yeah, somebody tried staging an attack to start a war. And it didn't do Adolf any good in August 30th, 1st of 1939.
Yeah, you're talking about Poland.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't actually stage an attack. He just claimed that there was one. He said that the Polish were massing their troops along the border, didn't he?
He dressed up German soldiers, prisoners, German people from jail in like Dachau, mm-hmm. dressed them up in Polish uniforms.
Oh.
They actually staged it.
Somehow I missed that.
Yes. In fact, I had a good friend of mine in college whose father was with the SS in an anti-aircraft battalion. He still claims that it was a justified attack. That's how good their propaganda machine is.
Wow.
But that's the same thing we're seeing from our friends like Mr. Hannity and Mr. O'Reilly is, you're right, it's a big lie. It's right from the playbook.
Yeah.
Repeat it loud enough and strong enough, and plenty of times it'll become a fact.
Yeah, there you go. Dennis, thanks a lot.
But right now, the other thing I think is the chickens coming home to roost time, and I'm not saying that they're rife with things here, but don't they vet people at DHS?
Yeah.
How did this guy slip through the cracks? And he was arrogant enough
to brag about his job. Yeah, to brag about his job. Well,
yeah.
You know, it's I think that what we have there, frankly, for those people who don't know what we're talking about, this guy at Department of Homeland Security who was just busted for soliciting sex in a chat room with, he was actually talking to a cop in Florida.
Right.
He thought he was talking to a 14-year-old girl. And if he was one of the morality police, you know, if he was like Jerry Falwell or one of those brigades, then I would be all over that story because then it would be about hypocrisy. But really, I think what this is the tragedy of a dysfunctional individual. And, you know, his job had nothing to do with the whole Bush morality thing.
But
so I just see this as, you know, just general stupidity and crime.
Given the same moment of time, they had a 19-year-old testifying in Congress how the federal government sat around and how his former, quote, members of his website did... Even said, go ahead, come after us. The federal government won't do anything.
Mm. Yeah.
Will they do something now? This is the funny thing. The confluence of these two events
just
shows you how this president...
It's all style over substance.
Is so out of touch with everything.
Yeah, it's absolutely style over substance. They are more concerned with things looking good and with the story being told their way than they are with any reality on the ground anywhere, including here in the United States,
yeah.
As you said, with health savings accounts. Dennis, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Travis in Ocala, Florida. Hey, Travis, what's up?
I was wondering if there's anything that's stopping or any reason why the UN or whoever's in charge of that hasn't brought George Bush up on the war crimes charges.
Actually, there are some, including former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, who have suggested that and have introduced tried to introduce such crimes, such things. And Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Studies, I believe it is, Center for Constitutional something. Alan Ratner's brother, in fact, he's an attorney in New York, a human rights attorney. He has tried to bring these kinds of charges against Bush in Germany, against Bush and Rumsfeld. And the German government at first allowed it and then disallowed it. The time is not right, apparently. None of our allies want to be on the wrong end of that one at the moment.
Oh, I got you. That makes a lot of sense. All right. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Sure. Good talking with you. Jerry in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
I need some information, and I thought you might be a good source of it.
Mm-hmm.
Where do I find each individual year how much our budget deficit or surplus is?
Wow. There's a number of websites that talk about this. Economyincrisis.com or .org, one or the other. I think it's .com. Economy in Crisis is one of the best websites on that. Broadly speaking, they deal more with the trade deficit than the actual budget deficit. The federal government publishes the statistics. I mean, they're there on the federal website. I'm just not sure where. I've got them around here someplace. They're not hard to find. You should be able to Google it without a lot of difficulty.
I just thought it'd be an interesting exercise to take to assume that Bill Clinton is responsible for 1994 through 2001.
Right.
And so on back and forward, and to see whether Republicans or Democrats have been better stewards of the Treasury.
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, the Wall Street Journal had actually a chart, you know, published in the paper sometime in the last 3-4 weeks showing the federal deficit. And it was just like, you know, Democratic presidents, not so bad. Republican presidents, awful. Off the scale, awful. When Bush was first elected, a friend of mine who's like really into stocks said, I'm getting out of the stock market. I'm going to buy gold. I'm going to buy oil. I'm going to buy copper. I'm going to buy commodities because this guy is going to, you know, this is what the Republicans always do. And he's making out like a bandit. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Caution! The following phrase has been recalled until further notice. Health savings accounts. Jeffrey Feldman with us, the editor-in-chief of FrameShopIsOpen.com. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom.
Why the warning on the top of your website? Caution, the following phrase has been recalled until further notice, health savings accounts.
Well, this is actually an article that I first posted over a year ago when the president started to push this proposal for setting up privatized health savings accounts as a solution to the insurance coverage problem in this country. It's a widespread problem where an increasing number of people in this country, you know, numbering in the tens of millions, are unable to get health insurance and therefore are outside of our system of medicine. And as a solution to this, the president was talking about over a year ago, in 2004, the idea that Americans should start saving up cash into an account and then using this money that they've saved up to enter into a competitive marketplace where they would get the best deal on health insurance. The problem with this approach is that the president is basically saying that if you're wealthy, you can be healthy in America, which is the wrong approach. He is saying that the markets will cure the problem that we have with health insurance. And that's not how Americans think about health insurance, and we shouldn't be distracted by that. We should think about our nation's health taking place at the level of communities. Communities pulling together to take care of people, not markets, in order to deal with the health coverage problem.
Now, on your website, you say, do not use this phrase. If you or someone you know is currently using this phrase, please go immediately to Frame Shop for repairs. What phrase should we use?
I think that we need to talk about healthy families. I think this is one of these ideas coming out of the White House that we need to criticize. We need to draw attention to it and knock it down. I like the idea of talking about the president's proposal as Big Mac medicine, drive-through doctors, things like that. And we should draw attention to how.
I think some people, the old doc in the box days is, remember the when there was quite a fad in the 1980s to have these kind of drop-in doctor offices things, and I don't see so many of them. Well, actually, maybe it's because I moved out of Atlanta. Maybe they're still there, but they seem actually kind of convenient. And Walmart is talking about doing this now, with nurse practitioners.
Well, it's a great idea to have widespread and available clinics that people can go into to deal with everyday, regular, low-impact medical issues. The majority of the problems that people are facing are not heart transplants, but getting vaccines for their kids, making sure they've got all kinds of checkups. So we should be talking about those types of low-level solutions, everyday solutions for everyday people. But talking in market terms and using the president's notion of a savings account, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. There's got to be a way to take that phrase, health savings account, and turn it into something like, something that implies converting your life savings into Bill Frist's daddy's fortune. That's one for us all to ponder, I guess. Another one you have on your blog over here at frameshopisopen.com, Jeffrey Feldman. Frameshop, the party that asks the questions.
Yeah, this is really important, and this is going to come up, not just last week when I found this, but it's also going to come up next week on a completely separate issue. I first wrote this piece in response to the press conference that the Democrats gave last week in which they unveiled their plan for Iraq. And the argument that I was making is that it's fantastic that the Democrats marched out the Democratic plan for a 21st century military. It was great that Wesley Clark spoke about a new approach to dealing with the situation on the ground in Iraq. But the way that the Democrats were responding to the Republicans' demand that the Democrats issue a plan is very problematic. And what I say in that piece is that it's important for Democrats to take a leadership position in the debate by not answering the Republicans' questions over and over again, but by setting their own terms. It's great that they talk with authority and much more aggressively about what to do in Iraq, but they need to get away from feeling that they are compelled to answer Republican questions, and in particular to apologize to Republicans for things that the Republicans say that the Democrats are lacking on.
Yeah, like Bill Clinton in 1994 going down and apologizing for raising taxes that actually led to a balanced budget and prosperity in the United States.
Exactly. But this is a tried and true Republican tactic that they used in order to take control of debate when they're in trouble. They make demands against the Democrats. Say, you need to tell us this. You need to come up with this answer. Otherwise, you're not qualified to talk about this. These other issues that you're talking about. And the Democrats fall for it just about every time. They feel the need to reply to the Republicans when they pose these types of demands. They just need to stop doing that and be much more assertive in debate.
Right. Oh, your frame around immigration I thought was brilliant. I have been talking on this program for a couple of weeks now about how two things. Number one, the immigration issue is really part of a larger issue, which is the fact that the entire conservative agenda can be boiled down to two words, cheap labor. And cheap labor in China, for example, if you're manufacturing something in the United States, you can manufacture it cheaper in China because the labor over there is cheaper. But then there's jobs that you can't export. You can't export house building, for example. You can't export picking food. You can't waiting on tables and busboy and cook and things like that. And so cheap labor is being brought into the United States in the form of illegal immigrants. And this is really, part of the entire, Reagan with his amnesty in 86, a brilliant stroke as part of his campaign to destroy the unions, the organized labor movement in the United States, by further diluting the labor force in the United States. And you point out that there are really two borders that most Americans are concerned about. The Republicans are only talking about one. It's a great frame.
Yeah, the second border is the border between the underclass and the middle class, and then the society. The argument that the Republicans are putting out, and the president has really been the loudest voice on this issue, is that there are jobs in America that Americans will not do. Therefore, we need to allow a certain number of immigrants into the country in order to do these jobs. And every time this is discussed, and in particular, I was listening to C-SPAN Washington Today, which I listen to every morning, people were calling in and getting quite irate repeatedly about, in response to this assertion, saying this is absolutely not true. The problem with this immigration issue is that big business is facilitating these immigrants into the country so that they can get around fair labor standards laws.
Sure.
One of these great policies put in place by Roosevelt to guarantee that there would be a minimum wage and that there would be only a certain number of hours in the work week. And of course, when you think about what immigrant labor does for big business, is it allows them to circumvent these exact regulations that make a job in America actually something that can sustain a person and their family. So the real issue, the real frame here, should not be on building a wall on the border or the problem of immigrants flooding into the country, which was talked about. That phrase was used over and over and over again last week. But should be, I suggest, that we need to knock on the doors of big business and demand that they follow the labor laws that we already have in place. If we do that, we should be able to stem the tide of illegal immigration, and we can deal fairly with the people who are already in this country for a variety of reasons.
Right. Yeah. The point that I've been making is we don't need to criminalize the illegal aliens themselves or their families or anybody who feeds them, for example. If we simply criminalize the employers, then if there were no more jobs, probably the vast majority of them would say, okay, see you later, I'm going home. And those who stay behind because they married somebody who's a citizen or because they've been here for a long, long time and they're very committed to this country would begin the normal process of becoming citizens, you know, the real way, the legal way. And I don't think that we need to even change any laws to make that happen. You know, get in line. There's so much demagoguery around this issue, or demagoguery, or however you say it.
It's very difficult, and I think that, unfortunately, on both sides of the aisle, you have Democrats and Republicans who are convinced that certain voting districts in the 2006 election are going to be carried by constituents who are listening very closely on this issue. And so even Democratic leaders at the top of our party, when I listened to Bill Clinton give an interview on this, I believe it was on the Larry King show last week, and he was overly cautious on this issue. He was unable to articulate what this issue is really about from a progressive perspective, which is about enforcing fair labor standards.
Yeah. I wrote a piece about it for Common Dreams last week that laid this out. And I was amazed because I just laid it out, and I was amazed by the number of people who wrote to me. I only got two or three people who flamed at me, and I was expecting a lot, and hundreds of emails from people saying, you said what I have been thinking but haven't been able to say, didn't have the words to say, that this really is a progressive issue. The progressives from the late 1800s have been working to limit the availability of labor because of David Ricardo's Iron Law of Wages from 1814. Limit the amount of labor, you drive up the price of labor. Drive up the price of labor, and you can create a middle class. Otherwise, as Ricardo said, in an unlimited labor environment, you're going to have subsistence wages. And that's called the working poor. That's the two borders that you're talking about, the Mexican border and the border between the middle class and lower class. Brilliant. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com. Jeffrey, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We live in the land of plenty, but many things aren't plenty anymore. Like the water from our sink, they say it's not safe to drink. You gotta go and buy it at the store. Now we're told there's a hole in the ozone. Look at what's washing on the beach. And Lord, I believe from the heavens to the sea, we're bringing Mother Nature to her knees. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only ours to follow. Let's save some for tomorrow. Leave it and pass it on down.
Sounds like a plan. 22 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Tom DeLay yesterday on the Chris Matthews Show. This, a little clip from before they went on the air, posted over at the HuffingtonPost.com blog.
You're kidding.
I am not kidding. They didn't like Edwards. They thought he was a rich lawyer pretending to care about poor people.
Yeah.
Hillary was know-it-all.
So Chris says, and Hillary was a know-it-all, and then Tom DeLay offers his opinion.
I don't know.
Nothing worse than a woman knowing.
Seven.
Nothing worse than a woman knowing.
Thanks. I owe you one. I owe you two.
No, you don't.
Today and last night. No, yeah. I do.
I appreciate.
Yeah, and Chris owes him a whole bunch of them. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. TalkRadioNews.com, their website. Always a lot of good audio and news over there. Hey, Victoria.
Was that real, Tom?
That is real. In fact, I can play. Here's a little bit. This is
Thank you for calling me.
Well,
it was a good thing for me, honestly.
Was it?
Oh, of course it was. We got on the air as fast as we could.
Yeah, well.
You didn't know there was any.
There wasn't any.
If Shannon had told me there was an embargo, I would have honored it, but I didn't.
She told me. I didn't tell you that.
It just goes on. I mean, there's the whole conversation, you know, that's off the air, and then they give him the 10-second cue, and then he goes live. And I'll bet the folks over at Matthew's Show are just, you know, going nuts on this thing. You know, how did this little piece of video get out of here?
Well, that's a very good question.
Yeah.
Do you know an answer to that or not?
Over on Huffington Post, it simply says, thanks to the usual source gods. But, you know, once again, here's Tom DeLay about know-it-all women.
Thanks. I owe you one.
Oops.
I owe you two.
Excuse me.
No,
you don't.
Here we go. No, it's...
I don't know.
Nothing worse than a woman knowing.
There you go. Yeah. Tom DeLay.
Did he say a woman lawyer or a woman know-it-all?
Woman know-it-all. Yeah. Chris Matthews said to him that Frank Luntz's survey found that people thought of Hillary Clinton as a know-it-all. And DeLay's response was nothing worse than a woman know-it-all.
Yeah, I hate those women know-it-alls.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm speaking to one of the better ones here. What do you know, Victoria?
What do I know? Well, what I know is I start to feel like I don't know it, because the Daily Telegraph reported over the weekend that the British government and defense chiefs were going to be holding this meeting on Monday, which apparently was held, mm-hmm. in which they were going to be talking about a targeted strike on Iran, a strike that would be led by the Americans, and that, you know, was something that they anticipated that they were, it was called inevitable if Iran basically dissed the United Nations Security Council.
Right.
And I asked Scott McClellan about this yesterday, and, well, he didn't know about the story, which I started to second guess myself because I didn't have it in front of me at that minute, and I started to think, well, maybe it wasn't really there. Maybe it was a spoof story. Maybe it wasn't.
No. McClellan is just making it up. In fact, Joseph Cirincione?
I'm looking at his article. Fool me twice as we speak, Tom.
There we go. He says, for months I have told interviewers that no senior political or military official was seriously considering a military attack on Iran. In the last few weeks, I have changed my view. In part, this shift was triggered by colleagues with close ties to the Pentagon and the executive branch who have convinced me that some senior officials have already made up their minds. They want to hit Iran. What I previously dismissed as posturing, I now may believe may be a coordinated campaign to prepare for a military strike on Iran. And this is a guy who's, you know, with the Carnegie Endowment.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and what I got on the record yesterday, and the sound is on there if you want to use it, was the question of whether any similar talks had taken place or were planned to take place here, and also whether Bush and Blair have discussed this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got no answers to any of those questions, but I just want everyone to remember I asked it.
Yes, and you did, and good on you. Also, at that press conference, Bush made this comment.
They're trying to create enough chaos so that America loses nerve, and I'm not going to lose my nerve as the president.
He's not
going
to lose his nerve?
That was going to be my question until I realized I needed to do the Iran question, because that's exactly what I heard in those remarks that he had after that meeting that he'd held. I thought to myself, I'm not going to lose my nerve. I may still have to ask it. Is losing your nerve the same thing as changing a policy?
Right. Or being intelligent about doing something,
right.
Particularly military policy. I mean, you have to be able to say, you know, plan A didn't work, go to plan B.
I find it fascinating. You heard the same thing because nobody else noticed that I'm not going to lose my nerve. I thought it was crucial.
Oh, and I also think it's political posturing. I think there was an insight into the psychology of him, but I think he was also trying to take the political posture that he's the tough guy, and he's not facing any bullets.
No, he's
not the tough guy. The tough guys are over in Iraq, and those men and women are living through hell because George W. Bush doesn't want to lose his nerve. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Yep.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Well, it's called the Republican Party. Welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman program where we dare to ask the questions the mainstream media is afraid of. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, for all things Macintosh, iPod, and frankly, all things PC. Welcome back to our program. Is our trade policy, I raised this question at the beginning of the first hour, and we haven't yet had an opportunity to drill down into it. I want to get into it somewhat, at least today. We can't let this thing slide by. This Reuters story about China talking about our debt. Is our trade policy, or are our trade policies, international trade policies, threatening the survival of this nation? And in my opinion, they are. They very clearly are. At least threatening the survival of this nation as an independent nation, as the United States of America. Now, you know, we may become the land of the serfs of the multinational corporations. And in fact, we are quickly becoming that. And government will become a caricature of itself. It'll become a cartoon. And we'll pretend that we have democracy. And we'll pretend that we have a middle class, when in fact what we'll have is indentured servitude. I mean, the level of debt now in the United States is higher than it has ever been in the history of this country, both in real numbers and as a percentage on personal basis. And there are two kinds of debt that we have at the federal level, at the national level. There's two kinds of debt that the government generates. The first kind of debt is called the budget deficit. Year by year, and then you add every year you add to it, and it's the national debt. Okay, and that's the amount of money that is the difference between what we bring in taxes and what we spend out on everything we spend on, you know, everything the government spends money on. And Bill Clinton actually got us to a point where we were bringing in more in taxes than we were spending out in the cost of government, and so we were able to pay down the debt of previous presidents, because it's been pretty stiff ever since the Vietnam War, and Ronald Reagan just blew it into the stratosphere when he came into office with his crazed supply-side economics, his insane conservative economics. It just plain old flat-out didn't work, and he had to start borrowing from the Social Security Trust Fund. He didn't actually initiate that. It started back, you know, under LBJ, trying to cover up the cost of the Vietnam War. But then, you know, when the baby boomers in the early 80s started paying for their own retirement, the Social Security Trust Fund started growing really quickly. And Reagan borrowing from that. In any case, that's one kind of debt. The other kind of debt is the debt that we as a nation have relative to the rest of the world as a consequence of our doing business with them. Okay, so the first kind of debt, the national debt, you could think of sort of like as a family debt. Let's say that you're a family and you also have a little family business. Let's say that you run a little convenience store downstairs and you live upstairs. Okay, you got a family and you got a family business. And the amount of money that you earn from running that convenience store versus the amount of money that you spend on your cable bill and your electric and your rent and all that kind of stuff as a family, that's like the national deficit and the national debt. And the national debt, we just raised the ceiling on, it's pushing $9 trillion now, which is mind-boggling. It's enough, if it was $1 bills, it would reach from here to the moon and back and halfway back there again. But then there's also what's called the trade deficit. And the trade deficit would be the same thing as, say, you run this family business downstairs in your house, and you're buying inventory and you're selling inventory. And let's say that you know, and normally you'd want to be selling as much as you're buying, right? So if this year you buy $10,000 worth of stuff, you know, bread and Twinkies and Coke and whatever, you buy $10,000 worth of stuff, you sell $10,000 worth of stuff, or $11,000 or $12,000 worth of stuff, and you show a profit. Or at least you break even. But what if you sold $10,000 worth of stuff, but you bought $20,000 worth of stuff? Well, now you owe your suppliers $10,000. What if you sold $10,000 worth of stuff, but you bought $30,000 worth of stuff? Now you owe your suppliers $20,000. That's our trade deficit, the difference between what we sell to other countries and what we buy from them. And if you're that shopkeeper who has bought $20,000 worth of stuff and only sold $10,000 worth of stuff, and your creditors come to you and say, okay, you owe us $10,000. What are you going to do? Well, over the short term, you can say, well, I'll pay you interest on it. And to a large extent, that's what's been happening with our trade deficit. It is also funding our debt, and we're paying interest on it. But at a certain point, they're going to say, you know, we don't want to loan this money to you. You bought stuff from us. Now we want stuff from you. So we're going to come and we're going to take all the stuff on aisles 1 and 2 in your little store there, and we're going to take all the chairs and tables. And that's the equivalent of the Germans coming over here and saying, we're going to buy Chrysler. Or Bertelsmann coming over and saying, we're going to buy Random House. Or the Chinese coming over and saying, you know, we're going to buy Amoco. Or Dubai coming over, the United Arab Emirates coming over and saying, we're going to buy the ports of Philadelphia and Boston and Baltimore and New Orleans and so on. And you can only maintain that trade deficit as long as people are willing to either hold your debt or continue selling you things on credit and continue accumulating, you know, your debt instruments, whether they be your dollars or your, if you start running the printing presses, or your treasury notes. So it becomes very dangerous when the major holder of your debt says, you know, we're going to call in your loan. So here's this story from today's Reuters by Kevin Yao and Benjamin Kang Lim. I'm assuming it's probably datelined out of Hong Kong. The headline, senior China official urges cut in U.S. debt holding. China should trim its holdings of U.S. debt, a senior Chinese official said, rattling markets in the run-up to a visit by President Hu Jintao to Washington this month. As China is a leading financier of the U.S. current account deficit. Now, the current account deficit is another way of saying basically the trade deficit plus. As China is a leading financier of the U.S. current account deficit and holds the world's largest foreign exchange reserves, the comments of Sheng Shiwei, a vice chief of the national parliament, sent the dollar and U.S. government bonds lower. They go on to note, any move by China to sell some of its massive debt holdings could drive up long-term. You say, well, what does this matter to me? Why should I care about this? Well, here's why. Any move by China to sell some of its massive debt holdings, that's U.S. debt, could drive up long-term rates, which ultimately could make it costlier for Americans to take out home mortgages. Because what happens is, when other countries say, no, we're not going to buy your debt anymore, then we have to say, if we're going to continue living in debt, both a trade surplus, a trade deficit. Keep in mind, we had a trade surplus right up until Reagan came along. Literally from the founding of this country in 1776 until Reagan came along, we had a trade surplus. The rest of the world owed us stuff. We were buying businesses in other countries. And when Reagan declared war on the United States of America and declared war on the working people of this country, on behalf of the multinational corporations, that began to turn around. And now we have we are the number one debtor nation in the world. After being one of the world's largest creditor for most of the 20th century and one of the world's largest creditors for most of our history. So if the countries like China, for example, say, you know, we don't want to buy your debt anymore. We're not going to hold your debt, and we're going to start selling it. And we're going to continue to borrow money in order to get people to loan us that money. In other words, to buy our treasury bills, because a treasury bill is just an IOU. We sell our IOUs. In order to get people to buy our debt, in other words, to loan us money, we have to offer them more, a greater rate of return. And they say, you know, I'm not going to buy your debt for 3%. I want 4%. I want 5%. I want 6%. I want 8%. I want 10%. I want 12%. And as they hit like 10, 8, 10, 12%, as the treasury rate starts going up, then all the other interest rates in the United States go up as well. And two things happen. Number one, the cost of your home mortgage. If you have an adjustable rate mortgage, you're in deep trouble. The cost of your home mortgage can explode. And the second is that businesses which are operating on debt, as most American businesses are these days, find that the cost of their debt service goes up. They have to pay more and more in interest. And the federal government, for that matter, has to pay more and more in interest. And so government services are cut back because more money is going to debt service. And businesses can't expand. They can't grow. And so they start contracting. They start shrinking. And you fall into a recession or a depression. And the number one Chinese official, the president of China, Hu Jintao, coming to Washington this month. And this is the kind of stuff they're saying in advance with this. Hu meets U.S. President George W. Bush in Washington on April 20th. U.S. officials say Hu's visit will focus on trade issues as the Bush administration seeks to narrow its trade gap with China, which hit a record $202 billion last year. And China's saying, you know, we don't want to loan you this anymore. 45 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
But no one can say I never tried. Oh, we just get one right around the sun in this dream of time.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. For your daily, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. And time now for
Walmart.
Our Walmart alert.
If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big company sell at low cost. Drive mom and pop out of business. Pretty soon all over the land. One big square store. I think of a brand, and that's why I hate Walmart.
Walmart blocks tighter port security. This from the Center for American Progress. A new report by the AFL-CIO shows that Walmart and its lobbyists, the Retail Industry Leaders Association, have systematically worked to weaken port security by investing heavily in the members of Congress. Investing. Yeah, it's like guys go to Las Vegas to invest in the bunny house or whatever it is out there. It's by investing heavily in the members of Congress with the most sway over ports and supply chain security issues, as well as the Bush administration and the Republican National Committee. Since 2000, Walmart has given $173,000 to 18 of the 19 Republican members on the House Homeland Security Committee. Four of the committee's 14 Democrats also accepted donations, a total of $18,500. In 2005, RELA, this is the Retail Association, the lobbyist for Walmart, bragged about its opposition to regular and independent inspections of supply chain practices, security practices, and lobbied against tougher rules requiring Walmart to inform U.S. Customs what is being shipped in and where it is coming from. Walmart's investments in lobbying seem to have paid off. Recent congressional legislation to tighten port security would also relax customs inspections for large importers like Walmart. So our Walmart alert for the day.
I hate Walmart.
There you go. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Patricia in Sacramento, California. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Hey, Tom. When you were just talking about the trade deficits and all these horrible things that are happening to our country, you know, I honestly believe the Bush administration does not care. I mean, I've concluded to that because you look at everything they've done from Katrina to the war in Iraq. I mean, they've had people, you know, experts tell them, you know, look, the war in Iraq, you know, it's not going to be successful. You're going to have, you know, people that are going to be fighting against your soldiers. I'm going to switch phones real quick. Sorry.
Sure.
Sorry, Mike. Sorry, Tom.
That's quite right.
And so I've come to this conclusion that they just do not care. They see, if you dismantle the middle class and you don't have educated people, corruption is, it's easier to exist.
Yeah. Bush said that he was going to bring us a CEO presidency. That's what we're seeing. He said he's going to run the country like a business, and that's what you're seeing. It's being run like Enron.
Absolutely. And one quick thing, Tom. You know, you had a caller when you were talking about King George and you're comparing it to President Bush.
Right.
And it just amazes me to hear people that still support this president. And I just asked this caller to look at one item, at least one, where President Bush was in.
You still there?
9/11. And what his comment
was.
I'm sorry,
Patricia, I missed your last sentence there.
I'm so sorry. He was asked about the connection between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, and George Bush responded, "Oh, I never remember connecting Saddam Hussein to 9/11. I mean, how much audio do we have of Bush and Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney constantly saying that Saddam Hussein was supplying al-Qaeda? I mean, it's just.
Yeah, here is actually George W. Bush. This is a year ago.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Yeah. We have no evidence. It was a year ago he said that. And then again he said it a month ago at a press conference. But still, 70% of our troops believe that that's why they're in Iraq. Because of 9/11.
And Katrina, Tom, let's not forget, when he says, I could not have foreseen the breach of the levees. Then we find out there's a 3-4 hour videotape of him being instructed that there, you know, the levees will break and that Louisiana is going to become a soup bowl. I mean, it just goes on and on. 9/11, the comments about the wiretapping when he said, oh, you know, by the way, when we wiretap, you know, we need a court approval.
Right.
And then you find out 2 months later, he's wiretapping without the court approval.
For 3 years.
Unbelievable. So it just amazes me that people still support him. I just ask people, think, please, use your brain and think.
I agree with you, Patricia. Thank you very much. Well
thanks,
said,
Tom.
And thanks for the call. I think that the few people who are still supporting him are people who are, frankly, just not paying much attention to the news. And it might be that they're, like, you know, into sports and entertainment, and they just don't, you know, they're not into news. Or it could be that they're just working so many jobs and working so hard that they don't have the time to pay attention to the news. Joy in Humboldt County, California, or Jay, rather. Hey, Jay.
Hi, Tom. Good morning. There's one big lie out there, which even I've heard you repeat, and that is that there are jobs that Americans won't take.
I've never said that.
Oh,
I've never said that, Jay.
Okay. Well, then,
the point that I make is when I was growing up, the number one show on TV was the Jackie Gleason show, and his Art Carney, his best friend, the character that he played, worked in the sewers of New York City and came home every day smelling of the sewers.
Right. That's my point, is that there are no jobs that people won't take if you pay them enough. And
that's
just part of the sentence they always leave out. There are jobs Americans won't take because they're not being paid enough, because anybody will do anything if you pay them enough. I mean, there are guys in Iraq getting shot at coming home in body bags for $2,000 a month. So we have to end that lie when somebody says, well, there are jobs Americans won't take. They've got to be stopped right there and say, at minimum wage. Finish the darn sentence.
Yeah, there you go. I agree with you, Jay. Absolutely. And it's a mantra here. Don't worry.
Okay.
Absolutely. Okay, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. And thanks for listening to KGOE there. And another KGOE caller, David. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. You are very courageously and clearly spelling out for us just how dangerous this White House crew is right now. You touched on something that a world court. Is it not possible that some skilled attorneys can argue this somewhere?
I think so. The problem is it's going to take a nation withstanding, and no nation who is an ally of the United States right now is willing to go before the world court and push this thing. But that may change. That certainly could change if Bush was impeached. It could change if there are hearings held in Washington, D.C., if the Democrats take back the House or the Senate, and they just begin investigating this thing and find evidence domestically of crimes. Then you could see some sort of international inquiry into this thing. So it's a possibility. And you raise an important one, Dave. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
1,020 days, 10 hours, 55 minutes, 10 seconds left until George W. Bush leaves office, assuming that there is not an impeachment between now and then. Welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour. It's the third hour of our program here, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Residents of Massachusetts, by the way, will be the first in the nation required to carry health insurance, writes Julie Appleby in the USA Today today, just as motorists in many states are required to carry auto insurance. You have George Bush out there saying one thing, and we have states doing something else. First, here's Bush.
We've been having a discussion here today about how to make sure our health care system meets certain objectives. One, empowering the patients. Two, how do we have a system that helps control rising costs in health care? And one of the interesting and innovative ways to do that is through health savings accounts. Health savings accounts are good for the uninsured.
Wait a second. Good for the uninsured. If you're uninsured, you're probably uninsured because you can't afford health insurance. So how can you afford to set aside a couple $1,000 a year so that if you get sick, you can then spend that money to get yourself well? I don't get it. He continues.
They're good for small businesses. They're good for larger corporations.
First of all, how are they good for small businesses? Well, I guess because they can shift the burden of paying for health care off the shoulders of the small business. It's really a difficult thing for a lot of small businesses to be able to provide health care benefits to their employees. And, of course, it's good for big businesses. It's that much more money the CEOs can pay themselves, right? It's that much more money that can be distributed to the stockholders in dividends.
And people around the table here have been sharing their experiences with how folks are saving money.
And the reason that they're saving money, because they're spending their own money on health care. And they're spending their own money on health care, and therefore they're going out and carefully shopping. For example, you have a heart attack, you call four or five hospitals, say, hey, I'm having a heart attack. How much do you charge? You know, I want to know right now. I got to know quick. And I'm sure that, you know, hospitals and ambulance services all over the country right now are just gearing up for people with health savings accounts to be able to quickly answer those questions. Hey, I just broke my arm, fell off the roof here, and I want to know how much you charge to set the bone in an arm. $2,200? Well, you know, the hospital down the street said they were $2,100. Yeah.
Through health savings accounts. And I would urge the small business owner or the individual who is concerned about his or her health care to take a look at a health savings account.
Yeah, if you got enough money. I mean, keep in mind, this is a guy who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. As Molly Ivan says, he was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. Has never had to work in his life. He was born with a trust fund, born a multimillionaire into a family, a dynastic family of millionaires. And he's telling us, he's telling the middle class, he's telling average Americans how they should be thinking about caring about health care.
We talked about the importance of cost savings to these important products, but we also talked about how we can work with the United States Congress to strengthen them, to make them more appealing, to give people more choices in the marketplace.
Just what I need, more choices in the marketplace. So if I break my arm, I now have to make 15 calls instead of 5, right? Is that the point? I mean, this is what they brought us with a Medicare drug benefit. I take Lipitor and I also take aspirin or Vioxx or whatever. Yeah, I don't take anything. But, I mean, it's as the prototype consumer. Well, let's see. On this insurance plan, this drug is covered. On this insurance plan, that's drugs. And there's 70-some-odd plans out. Yeah, right. That's all we need, George, more choices.
To say to the American people, we trust your judgment. We trust you to make the right decision for you and your family.
Yeah, you should make the right decision for you and your family when it comes to health care. You don't need a doctor. Whoever thought that you might need a doctor? After all, you should be able to diagnose yourself. You should be able to make your own decisions. This is just so tragic. Well, Massachusetts has decided to do something about it. Massachusetts is about to become the first state to have universal health care. A Republican governor, Mitt Romney, who, mark my words, will be running for president in 2 years, is going to sign this bill, although it's being passed through and by a Democratic legislature. And basically what it says is if you can afford health care, you have to have it. It's just like with an automobile. Well, here's the New York Times news story. Pam Bollock wrote a really nice little summary of it. Individuals who can afford private insurance will be penalized on their state income taxes if they don't purchase it. So, you know, do you want to pay for the insurance or do you want to pay the income tax? Your choice. Most people will buy the insurance. And then she goes on to say, government subsidies to private insurance plans will allow more of the working poor to buy insurance. In other words, the government is going to help pay for insurance for the working poor and will expand the number of children who are eligible for free coverage. And businesses with more than 10 employers who don't provide insurance will be assessed a fee of as much as $295 per employee per year. Now, frankly, I don't think that fee is going to be enough. Having been an employer, you know, and having employed people and paid for health insurance, I've seen health insurance bills, you know, that run $500-$700 a month per person. And this is $295 a year as a penalty I'm going to have to pay if I don't want to pay $600 a month for health insurance for an employee, $6,000 a year, $7,000 a year. So, you know, it's a nice beginning, nice theory. All told, the plan is projected to cover 515,000 uninsured people, about 95% of the state's uninsured population, within 3 years, legislators said. Well, I'm skeptical, but I applaud the principle. Maryland, in the meantime, passed a law that said that any employer with more than 10,000 employees, the only one in the state, by the way, is Walmart, has to pay 8% of their payroll for health benefits or pay into a special fund. Illinois, this summary from USA Today, Illinois, after expanding a program so that children and families of all income levels can buy into a health insurance program, Illinois lawmakers are holding hearings in every legislative district to find out whether residents want to expand such coverage to adults and how. Maine in 2003 launched a health plan called Dirigo Health, after the state motto, Latin for I lead. It offers insurance to small employers and individuals with low-income residents receiving subsidies. Program funded with Medicaid money and special fees on health insurance premiums. About 8,000 have signed up so far. Although critics say this is well below the expectations of 130,000 people. So this is what I think is going to happen in Massachusetts. It's a good start. Good start. But no cigar. Tennessee, last week, Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen, is it? Proposed expanding coverage to children in households with incomes up to $50,000. Launching state-subsidized health insurance for low and modest income workers and creating a high-risk pool for adults with medical conditions. So here we have five states, Maryland, Massachusetts, Illinois, Maine, and Tennessee, that are all making some rather significant steps toward bringing about universal health care. Or something close to it. And in the meantime, what does George W. Bush want to talk about? Health savings accounts. Yes, you can have a savings account. And if you get sick, you can spend your own money. Good luck, Charlie. I really think that George W. Bush believes. This is how out of touch he and his multimillionaire advisors are. I think he really believes that if he can talk about this, it'll change the topic away from the disaster in Iraq, which will be a good thing for him. And it will cause Americans to say, oh, he really is concerned about health care. He's really trying to do some good. But I think the actual perception of George W. Bush by most Americans is something like this one. This is the Daily Feed, a little Bushism that they put together. It's obviously tongue-in-cheek.
Today I continue to speak about my conservation policies and the principles that will guide them.
So today I'm cutting down a sequoia. And I'm asking our park rangers to damage the roots of the sequoias. My administration will also destroy this place and these trees. And we will continue our work destroying the very things that draw people here. Because in the end, my administration would have done more harm than good.
Yeah, and it's actually a video, and it ends with a Bush-Cheney question mark. More harm than good, that's their slogan. And tragically, it's the case. And the reason why is very simple. It's very simple, very straightforward. It's really easy to understand when you get it that these guys came out of this world.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
They don't believe in government. If you don't believe in government, you can't govern. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And the people in the houses all go to the university, and they all get put in boxes, little boxes, all the same. And there's doctors, and there's lawyers, and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Larry Scott is with us, the chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org. Keeping an eye on the VA, because somebody has to. VAWatchdog.org. Hey, Larry.
Yeah, hi again, Tom. Good to be with you.
Great to have you here. Test vets. What is a test vet?
Well, a test vet is a common term that veterans use for those veterans who were exposed to, some of them knowingly, some not knowingly, chemical agents, biological agents, and radiological agents over the years. Some of these were volunteers who volunteered for vaccine programs or volunteered to be exposed to certain chemicals or biologicals, and then various other drugs, let's say antidotes or vaccines, were administered. Other just volunteered for programs that were called testing programs. One of those was done at the Edgewood Arsenal back east, where literally the veterans who went through that program have no idea what they were exposed to or what the purpose of the test was. What we have now is a group, the latest group of test vets. The VA was provided with a name of 7,000 veterans who during the 60s and 70s were exposed to chemical and biological agents, okay, by our government, not on the battlefield, but here at home. It could be anything from nerve gases to tularemia, anything of that nature.
Guinea pigs.
Guinea pigs. Yeah. That's
human guinea pigs.
Human guinea pigs.
So
exactly.
The VA has the names of 7,000 of them. What do they do?
Well, they're not doing much of anything, and that appears to be the problem. The VA was provided the list of names from various government agencies, but only the names. So first of all, the VA has to trace down who is this name. In other words, they have to put the name with a real person. Is that person still alive? They have to find that person. But the most difficult part is the names were provided without corroborating information as to what type of tests these people were involved in, these veterans, what agents they might have been exposed to, or what counter agents or vaccines. So even when the VA comes down and says, okay, here's Bob Smith, and we've identified him as the Bob Smith who lives in Akron, Ohio, they don't know what Bob Smith was exposed to, therefore they don't know what to do for him. Now, it's absurd, because if the names had been supplied properly in the first place, they would have been supplied either with the Social Security number or with a military ID number. Some of those right. names go back so far that you used your old military ID number and not a Social Security number. Right. If the names had been provided properly by the other government agencies, they also would have included where these people were stationed, what period of time they were stationed there, what type of tests they were involved in and what they were exposed to. But now the VA is left and they're throwing their hands up in the air saying, hey, we have to go dig this information out before we can notify the veteran. Yes, you might have been exposed to sarin nerve gas. You might have been exposed to tularemia. Therefore, your benefits are, and we'd like to help you. So what it is a big waiting game for the veterans. And most veterans groups who are involved with the test vets are saying this is baloney. That's a nice term they're using.
Mm.
They're saying that the VA is...
That's the word you could say on the radio.
That's the word I can say on your program. I know you have a family program. They're saying that the VA is stalling because, and I hate you, but I will quote a vet. So they really don't want to do this because the longer, if you wait long enough, we'll all be dead.
Right.
And I'm afraid that is the generally accepted attitude in the veterans community. If you stall long enough, the vets will die. We look back at the Agent Orange situation, Tom. You know, for years, the Department of Defense and the VA denied Agent Orange was a problem until independent testing and independent funding came out for the tests that proved, look, you've got a problem with dioxins, and here's what dioxins do, forcing the hand.
And there's still a problem with Gulf War illness, and yeah.
Well, we have Gulf War illness, which nobody really knows, nobody can really define properly. The British government about 2 weeks ago says Gulf War illness doesn't exist, that it just happens to be a group of people who have a bunch of abnormal symptoms, but there really is no illness. This brings us into the modern day, too, of exposure to depleted uranium. Where on one hand, you know, the DOD is saying, well, the amount of radiation is so small that it can't be a problem. It is flushed out of your system in a very short period of time. But most people who understand the concept of depleted uranium know that it's not the radioactivity as much as it is the heavy metal.
Right. It's a toxin. It's neurotoxin. It's toxic to the kidneys. It's like lead. I mean, it's a poison.
And so what they're dealing with is they're saying, well, look, you were in the Gulf in 1991, and you were exposed to this, but we can't find any radiation in your body. Well, radiation per se is not the problem. It's the exposure to heavy metals and what will happen over a period of time with that depleted uranium in the body.
Amazing. Or the radiation way back then could have done damage to DNA that now shows up as things like cancer.
Exactly, and they still haven't developed tests to find that.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org. The first step in privatizing the VA, another great story there. I encourage people to check out your website, VAWatchdog.org. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, there's a place where I live called Canyon, where Daddy taught me to swim. And that water is so pure, and I'm gonna make sure Daddy's grandkids can swim there like him. Now we all ought to feel just a little bit guilty when we look into the eyes of our kids. Cause brothers, it's a fact, if we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did.
So and welcome back. Yes, let's leave some blue in the skies, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And if you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and just click the live chat link and it'll get you in there. And I'm going to come to your phone calls in just a second. First, one of the folks in our chat room, Japan Man, listening in Japan, says he's up at 3 o'clock in the morning listening to the program and requested a couple of Bush clips. And so I just, by request, because, you know, every now and then it's useful to just revisit the wit and wisdom of George W. Bush. So here's just a couple quickies.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top. That encourages entrepreneurship. What we Republicans should stand for is growth in the economy. We ought to make the pie higher.
We ought to make the pie higher, don't you know? Well, here's another one.
This is an impressive crowd.
Yeah, a little loud.
This is an impressive crowd. The haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
There you go. Okay. And let's see, what's your opinion of poor people, George?
First, let me make it very clear, poor people aren't necessarily killers. Just because you happen to be not rich doesn't mean you're willing to kill.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. Thank you for illuminating us about that. And of course, the actual clip that Japan Man asked for.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
Yep. So, the wit and wisdom of George W. Bush for the day. Maybe for the week. I don't know. Maybe for the month. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Steve in Warwick, Massachusetts. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Yes. Are you going along with that last clip you just played there? And so I'd like to ask you a couple of questions and stuff. Don't you think George Bush is either a terrorist, antichrist, or a corporate thug?
Corporate thug I'll go along with, yeah.
All right, because he's lied to the world. He's killed innocent people all over the world, including our own people. Mm-hmm. You know, so with his policies and stuff with the health care and stuff, people are dying every day from their lack of health care, and our soldiers are being killed over there and stuff on a lie.
Yeah, no, Steve, I'm with you on that, and I think that we have some really serious problems here as a consequence of George W. Bush's policies, and as I said earlier, I believe that this is the logical result of following Reagan's logic, which has been pretty much prevailed in Washington, with the exception of a good chunk of the Clinton administration, which is that government is essentially bad or evil or wrong, and therefore government can't do anything, so therefore why govern? These guys don't believe in government, so they don't know how to govern, because their philosophy of government is that government shouldn't govern. It shouldn't be there. There should be no social contract. And so, I get it. I'm just, in terms of the hyperbole, though, I don't think we need that. I think it's just enough to say, like Democrats, the slogan should be, have you had enough yet? I think so. Jeff in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, great show.
Thank you.
Let me repeat something Sean said a couple of months back. I may not call in all the time, but I'm here pretty much every day, front and center. And I appreciate what you're doing, Tom.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
Hey, I wanted to mention something that's going on in the Denver-Boulder-Longmont area that I think is really neat. Some wacky liberal about a year or so ago thought it'd be a good idea to have war protests every week. Why just wait for the opportunity to come once a year? And that has grown from a fairly small group to we've got a dozen protests going on every week here in this area. My wife heads a group that stands at 92nd and Sheridan in Westminster, which is not Boulder. I call from Boulder because I work here, but I actually live in a very conservative area in Westminster. And the response that we're getting with a dozen people standing on the street corner by the Walmart and the Best Buy and all of those is really phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get, for every person that gives us the middle finger, I'm seeing probably at least a dozen, probably closer to two dozen people giving thumbs up and honking the horn and waving at us.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful to see this attitude changing now. And have you noticed you don't see the yellow ribbons anymore?
No, and you don't see the Bush Cheney bumper stickers anymore either. It's they're just kind of going away very subtly. And the same thing is happening here in Portland. And I do a morning show here in Portland as well. Before I do this national show, I do 6 hours a day of talk radio. And the 3-hour morning show from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific time, we promote this. Every week, Ben in Aloha, which is one of the suburbs here, calls in and says, tonight in Beaverton, we're going to have at Southwest 5th and Hall, we're going to have our meeting. And they're up to an average of around 40, 45 people now every Wednesday night. There's another one in Oregon City, which is, the little town down the road. There's another one down in Salem, which is the state capital. There's another one downtown every Friday. I mean, they're just springing up all over the place. And they've been going for 20, 30 weeks in some cases or longer. And they are all growing, and they are all, and we use the show as kind of like the central place for them to call in and let folks know about it, and that is just, what we do.
That's what we're seeing here, too.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's working very, very well. So do you have local radio in your area that's supporting this?
We do. AM 760 does Air America, and so that has been a good avenue for getting the message out.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's great, and that's a marvelous thing. So, Jeff, I suspect that it's even happening in cities where there isn't a local talk show, you know, that would publicize the local events. My sense of it is that this is happening all across the country, and good on you for doing it, and thanks for the call and for listening.
See you, Tom.
Appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Bye.
1-866-440-8466 KJ in Camas, Washington. Hey, KJ.
Tom, I had a question. Yesterday you were talking about the Dominionists.
Yeah.
Do you think the Dominionists and the corporatists are allied? Are they in bed
yes.
together?
Yeah, well, okay, what brought them together was the Republican Party. I mean, this is the strategy. In fact, Kevin Phillips lays this out in his book about the Bush dynasty, that George W. Bush's job on his father's campaign was to bring the evangelical community into the fold in the Herbert Walker Bush, the G.H.W. Bush campaign. And this alliance of the corporatists and the not just fundamentalist Christians, but the fundamentalist Christians who believe that the Constitution should be replaced by the Bible was born. And although they have different goals, they not only tolerate each other, they each thinks it's using the other.
Yeah, well, my message to the corporatists about biblical law is that under biblical law, charging interest would be prohibited, and every 50 years, you'd have to forgive everyone's debt. Now,
there you go. There you go. Yeah, well, let's bring back the Jubilee.
Right.
You know, well said. And of course, under biblical law, any child who talks back to his parents should be put to death. And, you know, if a woman wants a divorce, she gets put, you know, the list, you know, even New Testament. I mean, Paul saying that women should sit in the back of the church, you know, with their heads covered and be quiet. I mean, anytime somebody starts quoting the Bible, you could just, there are so many bizarre things in there that I mean, there's a lot of good in there as well, but there's so many bizarre things that you can just point out. That it stops them, right? It stops them.
Well, I just figured since financial services seems to be our number one industry now, that it would not be real impressed if they were not allowed to charge interest.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one. KJ, thanks for the call.
Sure.
Good to hear from you. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. A couple things, if I may. I briefly heard on the Rush Limburger, reminds me of Limburger cheese. Tom DeLay was on this morning. Just caught it by accident.
Uh-huh.
You know, Tom, I gave into the fax delay.
I beg your pardon? Oh,
Tom,
yeah.
I gave into the fax delay.
Right, yeah, he finally gave into the fax.
But I wanted to add, if I may, to your comment about, ragged anti-government, the whole
mm-hmm.
crowd anti-government.
Yeah.
But I think also, if I can suggest this, that financially speaking, if we don't level the playing field for the average worker, and they're still anti-union.
Who is still anti-union?
The Reagan Bush philosophy is still anti-union.
Oh yeah, I mean that was the whole thing was bust the unions, destroy the unions. That was you know, Reagan's two core things were, number one, stop taxing people who earn their money passively because that's considered productive. That is people who invest. And number two, which is the, you know, the most wealthy in America. And number two, break up the labor unions.
Until the American worker realizes this, and I'm not so sure they've realized it, they're going to have to take the bull by, they're going to have to get strong and start organizing again, just like voting.
Yeah, well, they're starting to figure it out. The problem is it's
right.
very difficult to organize when, A, the Labor Department is working against you instead of for you and refuses to enforce the actual labor laws that are on the books, which is the case, was the case under Reagan, was the case under Bush Sr., and is the case now. And B, when you've got a workforce that is dramatically diluted by illegal aliens, and C, when you've got a workforce overseas of a billion people who are willing to compete with you for those things that can be shipped overseas.
Thanks
so,
for
you know,
time.
Yeah, you're welcome, Gary. So until we do something about all three of these things, number one, you know, dealing with our immigration problem. Actually, I don't think that's number one. I think it's number three. But, you know, on the list, we'll say, you know, number three, dealing with the immigration problem. Number two, dealing with a trade policy, an insane trade policy that should be replaced by going back to the tariff system that built this country that we had for over 200 years, which equalizes for labor. Until we do this, and number three, enforcing labor law, the middle class is going to continue to vanish. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Burning up the atmosphere and cutting down the trees. The billion-dollar bombing of a nation on his knees. Anyone not marching to their tune, they call it treason. Everyone says God is on his side. See the lightning, hear the cries of the wounded in a world in holy war.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. It's an honor to talk to you.
Well, pleased you called. Thank you.
First time. Ever since the mid-70s when I saw the movie Rollerball with James Caan, I've had an interest in corporations. I own the DVD set called Corporation. And I've watched in recent years especially how it appears that multinational corporations are, first of all, very undemocratic in the way they're structured and the way they operate, but they seem to be meshing themselves across the world and competing with sovereign nations. And
well,
whenever
in the WTO, in NAFTA, and now under CAFTA, there are councils, basically courts. In NAFTA, it's called Article 11, and they're called Article 11 tribunals, I believe, that are made up of representatives of multinational corporations and governments, and they have equal say.
Yeah, well, whenever this Dubai Ports World controversy was biggest a couple weeks ago,
right.
I went to the website of Dubai Ports World and discovered that there's quite a few Americans at the top levels of that corporation. So I started looking around the Internet at other ones. It seems that a lady earlier that called you is who prompted me to call is because she said that George Bush and company don't really care about our problems, financial deficits or whatever. And I don't think that's quite true. I think they care a lot. But is there – what I wanted to ask you, my direct question to you is it possible that these people at the very top of this game of multinational corporations essentially putting their tentacles around the world in much the same way that Rollerball depicted in 1975, that they are, for all practical purposes, taking over?
Yeah.
And they don't really care
yes.
as much as the, because they're going to be out, coming out on top. It doesn't matter to them who owns the corporation. They're the major stockholders. They're on the board of directors of Dubai Ports World and of Walmart with its manufacturing facilities in China, whatever. They're like in a separate world.
Yeah.
All
well, in fact, you go to theyrule.net. theyrule.net, and just go to load map and just load a map. And for example, I just loaded a map.
Is that THD?
No, they rule. theyrule.net. And this map that I just loaded is called the Magnificent Seven. These are all made up by individual folks there. And for example, at the center they got J.P. Morgan Chase Company. And one of the directors is M. Anthony Burns, and he's also on the board of Pfizer and Black & Decker. And let's see, this is scrolling off my page here. And MetLife, and or JCPenney, rather. And then on the board of JCPenney, you've got Verdon Jordan Jr., and you've got Kent Foster. And Kent Foster is also on the board of directors of, let's see, it goes up here to New York Life Insurance, which has Betty Alwine, who's also on Rockwell Automation, who also is on the board, whose board also contains William H. Gray III, who's also on the board of J.P. Morgan Chase. We just made a circle.
Yep.
See, well, you know, this is the I mean, you want to talk about the international conspiracy, as it were. It's really not a conspiracy. It's right out there in public. It's right out there for anybody to see, you know, right out in front of the world. And, yeah, there is a corporate elite that is essentially running the world. And this is what George Herbert Walker Bush was talking about when he said it's a new world order. It's a new world order run of, by, and for the corporations. It's the idea that Mussolini had in the 1920s that he called corporatism and he later called fascism, the merging of corporate and state interests. And it's not what, you know, it's not Nazism. Nazism is a whole different thing. It's a form of cult-based dictatorship that Hitler had. He did not have fascism? Was it just a whole different thing? So anyhow, that's, and if you really want to get a good education, just spend some time over there at theyrule.net, loading various maps and looking at them. It's just fascinating. You can click on the people and they show all the different boards that each person is on. You can click on a corporation and it shows all the people who are on the boards. You can click on two corporations and see if they overlap or see how they overlap. It's really a remarkable piece of work.
Do you think Jennifer Granholm could possibly do some good?
In Michigan?
If she was to move from Michigan to Washington.
Oh, I think I have a lot of respect for Jennifer Granholm. I think she's a very good governor of Michigan, and I think she could. Jim, I got to move along. I just have a minute left.
Thank you.
Larry in Laconia, Washington is on the line. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
60 seconds. What's up?
Yeah, Iranian oil bore stuff here.
Yeah.
I think this explains why Premier Hu is coming to Washington. The problem with the oil bore theory was that everyone had to team up. Everyone that holds our debt had to team up, and I think that's what they have done. Because there are mutually shared economic destruction. If the dollar crashes, all their debt crashes too, and so forth.
Right.
And I think they've teamed up. I think this is
the Chinese and the Iranians. You mean
Chinese? Well, and everybody
and the Russians.
Yes, everybody that holds our debt. I think the Germans are in there too. They were at the meeting right the week before the bourse when they decided to delay. And so they'll take a huge hit. And I think they've made a sweetheart deal with Iran for their oil for the next 40 years or whatever, and they will recoup those costs. I think they have put it together.
They're not yet to the point where they can walk away from the dollar, but they're getting close.
I think they know how to do it now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And that's for your chat room, guys, to pick apart.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Good talking to you, and we'll continue the conversation as the week goes on. I appreciate you calling in, and thanks for listening to us there on Talk 1090 in Seattle. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, Robert Stacy McCain, author of Donkey Cons, Sex, Crime, and Corruption. Is it limited to one party? Bev Harris is going to be here about voting machines. And Gary K. Smith, author of Help, I Owe Back Taxes, talking about how we should change our tax system. That and more, and your calls right here in the Democracy Zone, the Tom Hartman radio program. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.